just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
We had big, big news this last Sunday. We had big, big news this last Sunday. The Heat beat the Celtics in game one of their basketball series. How about that, huh? Oh, there was other news, too. The Prez made a big announcement. Obama said, Osama's dead. The world is safer today. We got him, folks. He's not a threat to those who gave the orders. We'll all sleep better. Our Fall Guys letters and tapes no more will come in. We won't have to make them. We won't have to fake them. For him, the fish will say, we'll come in. Another hidden layer, another hidden player buried beneath the sea. But just in case a new law is in place, as soon as we push it through, we found a way to make you pay if you won't play along. No need for court. Lock you in a fort. Just try and sing the wrong song. The recipe for mass control is getting closer to you. Really doesn't seem to matter who's in charge in the White House or in Congress. It hardly even matters who's in charge in local government. One thing is for sure. Whoever it is that is in charge is not us. I'm Chuck Gregory. I now want to introduce my co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Weather report from Duluth. It's rainy. It's been rainy for April and May. More rain in the future, I think. Tonight, we welcome William Bloom from Washington, D.C., and Sherwood Ross from Coral Gables, Florida. So with all those involved, we're coming at you from D.C., Coral Gables, Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, and Vancouver, British Columbia. Okay, let's see. The American Dream, what is this all about? It's about becoming the sort of country we always said that we are. And perhaps that has never been more important than it is today. Buried at sea. Okay. Well, it is fascinating. It's exciting, breathtaking to be able to be a witness to life in the U.S. in the year 2011. There's no having to go back in a time machine or wonder, wow, what must that have been like? We are lucky in a way to be here now in person on the ground. I got to listen to my favorite sports talk show hosts display how very stupid they actually are, talking about the death of Osama bin Laden and the good old United States and the burial at sea. Maybe they are stupid, probably, very likely, if you look at the overall probability, but maybe they shoot sports show hosts, too. I don't know. I would just like to say that personally, whenever a United States president comes on national television interrupting regularly scheduled programming to announce that the evil genius of the world has just been killed, and thus all our murder and torture and stealing have been A-OK while I turn the other way. I think of George H.W. Bush coming on TV and saying the invasion of Panama was A-OK. Ronald Reagan cheerleading for the invasion of Grenada. I remember Lyndon Johnson saying the Warren Commission was A-OK and that something has happened in the Gulf of Tonkin. I remember all the so-called nightly news programs I have endured over decades that have told me that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy, and that Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. And remember President Roosevelt saying that the attack on Pearl Harbor was a total effing surprise, and so we had better get into the war now. Anybody remember Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford from the Warren Commission? And recall the whole genesis, the lineage of this charade, which began with the Supreme Court stopping the counting of votes in order to ensure that George W. Bush became president. and then his lying about the existence of weapons of mass destruction to get us into two wars, and also the fantasy of Jessica Lynch's rescue and the death of Pat Tillman. And now another liar, Barack Obama, saying that we just killed Osama bin Laden, who attacked us almost 10 years ago, and he is now dead. And so all the people we slaughtered and tortured, all the dead children, and all the millions, billions of dollars pocketed by the military and defense contractors and people in power, well, it was okay and good and right. And by the way, our soldiers fight for our freedom. So when we go to Libya and wherever else after that we go, just trust us because we know what we are doing. And when we stage the next terror attack against ourselves, and then a little bit later we all have to pull our pants down to climb on a city bus or order a glazed donut, well, go along because we know what we're doing. I'm sure they know what they are doing, but I'm also sure they would never tell us. And it's just very disheartening at times like this. They are just so very good at what they do. They get the crowds at the ball games chanting USA, USA, and crowds form at the White House fence to honor the killing of some person, and accentuating just how ignorant we are, how uncurious we are, and how totally effed up we are. There is no way any other view about this so-called event ever gets heard by the majority of people. The communication channels are totally controlled by the forces of evil, the bad guys. It almost makes you want to give up, move somewhere else, do something else. And a person might do that if it were possible, but it's not. It's always this way anyway here, day after day. But at times such as these, it's just more in your face, the neo-fascism and the stupidity and the bleeding of the mass of people. Some people say that Osama bin Laden died years ago, and just prior to 9/11, he was treated in a U.S. hospital in Dubai and visited by the CIA. Does anyone remember Michael Moore's famous movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, where he chose not to go to the core of the issue, even with the incredible opportunity his popularity provided him? But still, he did talk about the bin Laden family and how they were given quick passage out of the country immediately after 9/11. And wasn't George H.W. Bush, one of the conspirators against JFK, visiting with bin Laden's brother the day of 9/11? Sibel Edmonds, former FBI translator, said that Osama bin Laden worked for the U.S. government right up to the time of 9/11. One has to wonder why they chose now, whether they figured they had to do it sometime, or whether they considered always an ace in the hole they can use as needed and now was the best time. President Barack Obama knows that 9/11 was not done by Osama bin Laden and his so-called Al-Qaeda. Obama knows, even better than we do, that it was an inside job, probably by a combination of groups and individuals, and that members of the Bush administration were involved. And yet he has chosen to pursue the lie, to send people to kill and to die. And he has chosen to go even deeper into the dark with this recent bold-faced presidential podium national television lie about Osama bin Laden. He is a powerful liar, the most powerful liar in the world at this moment, our president. A powerful, dangerous, murdering liar. And what do we answer insects do in the face of such power? What can we do? A giant has kicked over our anthole yet again, just as we had got it kind of rebuilt. So we find ourselves out in the open again, darting here and there with twigs and sticks in our mouths, wondering what to do with ourselves. Well, the first thing to do is have a strong drink, be it strong coffee or tea or whatever, and then a strong laugh at the absurdity of our even trying to fight such a giant as Barack Obama. And then we get to work. He will surely crush us just with an absent-minded brush of his mighty hand and not even notice us as we fall screaming to our deaths from the armrest of his giant throne. But we have no choice because we are still breathing, still alive. We fight because we breathe. We fight for those who cannot fight, the children murdered and torn apart by the bombs of shock and awe, the thousands torn apart by the bombs in the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers, Senator Paul Wellstone murdered to clear the way for the invasion of Iraq. We fight like Sophie Scholl and the White Rose, who in the midst of mind-boggling uniformity and evil chose to act. They studied and learned and thought and sweated. They came together and chose to fight. They found a place and the means to produce pamphlets and mailed them. In Munich, in Nazi Germany, in the midst of its power, they mailed out leaflets that told the truth. Meager pieces of paper with ink and words against the most powerful force on earth. We can also do as much. And I submit that as long as there is one dirty, grizzled leaflet blowing around the streets of Duluth or Poughkeepsie or Omaha, then we are still the United States of America. Still with the potential for redemption, for the triumph of true patriots over these invaders who have seemingly conquered us for the time being. Of course, the members of the White Rose were beheaded, Rather than take the advice of the leaflets of the White Rose, the Nazi leadership chose to cut the heads from the bodies of the best and brightest their society had produced. And the brutes that we face may well do the same with us, but in the spirit of the young heroes of the White Rose, we do not consider that as a factor in the equation. We fight for those killed by our military in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have to, not that we choose to. We might easily choose to pull the cover over our heads and sleep forever. After all, we are Americans, used to comfort and convenience, but still, we are breathing, we are here, we are the ones that millions of the past and future depend upon. We are alive, we have one life to live, and this one life, we have been placed by God or Allah or Alan the alien right here, right now, in the very belly of the beast. And we might choose an easier path, but we have no choice. We fight and we name the lie and the liars. Remember the anthrax letters. They contain military-grade anthrax, not available to someone in a cave in the mountains. There were two letters. Each said, "Are you afraid?" These were not chiseled in stone by some Fred Flintstone wannabe in a cave, but they were made to look as though they had been and prepared and sent by those who were part of the plot against America on 9/11. Not Osama bin Laden, not Al-Qaeda. Rather, members of the CIA, the Mossad, and the Bush administration. Those who today tell Barack Obama what to say on national television, who feed his teleprompter. Years ago, the comedian Mort Saul was interviewed by an alternative newspaper. He was talking about the aftermath of the JFK assassination and the cover-up and what that all meant for America. To be very truthful, we are still in the aftermath of the John F. Kennedy assassination. We have not recovered from it. Some of the perpetrators are still alive and still operating with impunity in the U.S. The question put to Saul was, "What is the renaissance following this long, hard night that you also spoke about?" And Saul said, "We'll start pursuing the American dream again. I don't know if we'll ever realize it, but we're supposed to have the right to pursue it. And the renaissance will be that a groundswell of public opinion will flesh out the rascals because the CIA has infiltrated every area of our national life. I'm afraid that the country they subverted best was the United States." And the reason they can continue this enormous mind-boggling lie, this history-making effort to rule all the world and its resources, is because they remain practically all-powerful. But if there is something in the universe, some basic goodness, some God or some good spirit somewhere, then Barack Obama and his many faces of evil fight against that basic force of good, and we have a chance, a snowball's chance in hell, and I will bet on that snowball because I have no choice. The forces of evil desperately want us to be afraid. They need us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor at rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek.
And now on to the news briefs.
Chuck, we have two great guests today, and we wish to give them as much time as we're able. So for the news briefs, we'll just say that we suggest people go to the Nuclear Resistor at nuclearresistor.org to read about heroic people you will never hear about on the nightly news or national public radio. At the Nuclear Resistor website, you will be able to read about recent resistance actions against the Empire of Barack Obama in the United States military corporation and prison complex. Just real briefly, on Easter Sunday, 16 people were arrested at the Nevada nuclear test site. On Good Friday, 33 people were arrested at Livermore Labs in Livermore, California. On Good Friday, three Catholic workers were arrested in London at the home of the Prime Minister. The annual Holy Week Faith and Resistance Retreat was also held in D.C. Over 40 people gathered to participate in the annual retreat sponsored by Jonah House and the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker. Included were acts of nonviolent witness at the White House and Pentagon. On Good Friday, 37 people were arrested at Hancock, the New York National Guard base. Also, just in, 50 protesters were arrested Monday in Kansas City. There is a nuclear, new Honeywell nuclear bomb plant being constructed there. For more information, go to thenuclearresistor.org. And that's the way it is, May 5th, 2011.
And now we'd like to welcome Sherwood Ross, a regular radio columnist for the New American Dream. Sherwood's a veteran journalist, now directs the Anti-War News Service, his reporting and commentaries on political and military topics appear on hundreds of internet sites globally. Sherwood, take it away.
Hi. You know, I've wanted to talk to you forever so long because I feel anyone who tunes in to the New American Dream might just share some of my values for peace, social justice, quality, environment. So I want to begin with a poem I wrote that I've been reading in bookstores and libraries here in Miami because it stresses some of these values, what people of different countries have in common. The idea for this poem came years ago when I heard the famous Russian poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko read, and he was truly unforgettable. So I bought his book titled Bratsk Station, about a power plant they were building out in Siberia called Bratsk Station. And one poem told how after the workers finished for the day, a group of them built a bonfire out in the woods and cooked their dinner and took turns reading their own poems by the firelight. So I've written a poem about Yevtushenko and added a few lines about what people of different nations have in common, and about how some politicians have come to threaten our very existence. This poem is called Russia and Argentina. Yevgeny Yevtushenko, I read your night of poetry and I am awed. I sleep with pens and a yellow legal pad beside my bed, yet nothing so wonderful day or night pops into my head as the poetry you and your friends read around the campfire on the banks of the Blue River running deep in the woods of Siberia, in the dark night under stars hanging down big as lanterns over Bratsk, where you have built the immense power plant. For the first time in my life, I long to be a Russian. It's more than the way you describe your beautiful country. It's your love of life that I admire, the intensity of your feeling, your poetry, your music, your animated conversation, each person reading his or her own verse while the thick soup cooks in the kettle over the open fire, while the vodka disappears down burning throats, while the show-offs dance kicking up their boots, while women offer their delicious mouths in the woods and Serenka, your accordion player squeezes out a tango from the distant Argentine. Ah, the Argentine. Can it be as beautiful as your Bratsk? In a few hours, the Argentine will be under its own starry sky. Yes, under this same fat yellow moon climbing up the horizon like a great wall clock, honoring the hours of the night. Is someone there in Cordoba on the Pampas picking up a Spanish guitar and softly, sweetly playing Moscow Nights in answer to your tango? There on the other side of the world in the Argentine, do I hear Juan Gelman reading his poetry, reading from unthinkable tenderness? Yes, and it is the same Juan Gelman whose family fled Russia during the revolution to find sanctuary in Argentina, only years later to have Argentine generals in their dirty war against the people arrest Gelman's young son and wife and murder them both. Just as Stalin arbitrarily sent both of Yevtushenko's grandfathers to the gulag. Explain it to me. Tell me. I do not understand. Is there no government that will let its people live in peace? Listen, friends, pick up your ears. Listen to the wind rising, for the wind carries the voices of the poets forever around the curve of the earth in oratorical orbit. Hear the two poetic voices calling out across the oceans, from Russia, from Argentina, as with one voice, love one another. Only love one another. So that's the poem. It's a story about how governments tyrannize their own people, as well as the people of other countries. And it saddened me the other day to read the New York Times coverage on Osama bin Laden that called him the most feared terrorist in the world. They must not have read the polls, because after the U.S. attacked Afghanistan and Iraq, a lot of people polled around the world said they thought George Bush was a bigger terrorist than bin Laden. You know, America today is two different countries. There's the plutocracy, a minority but very influential group driven by greed and power out to get their hands on the oil resources of the Middle East by any scheme. Then there's the rest of us, the vast majority of Americans who only want peace and prosperity for ourselves and our families. These plutocrats are real. Take Ray Hunt of Hunt Oil Company, Dallas. He's a buddy of George Bush. Hunt served on the board of the American Petroleum Institute, so he's a big-time oil man, many industry awards. After the U.S. conquers Iraq, Hunt makes a separate deal with Iraq province Kurdistan, even though, as the New York Times reported in 2007, the deal runs counter to American policy and undercuts Iraq's central government. So Hunt gets his free pass to develop Kurdistan's oil riches. The path likely will give him a share of the boodle from any future gushers. I say likely because the pact is a secret. Nobody knows. A State Department official told the New York Times, and I quote, Hunt would be the first U.S. company to sign such a deal. And reporter Jay Price in the McClatchy News Service said that Iraq's oil minister in Baghdad called the Hunt deal illegal. I repeat, called the Hunt deal illegal. So one big beneficiary of the war that has ruined Iraq, costed hundreds of thousands of innocent lives, cost the American public 5,000 lives lost military, and $3 trillion, one beneficiary is Ray Hunt of Dallas. Is it just a coincidence? President Bush's friend Ray Hunt's oil company got the first drilling rights in Iraq? Maybe it is. And it's even a bigger coincidence that Ray Hunt contributed $35 million to the George Bush Library. That's right, $35 million. I wonder where he got the money. He must have hit a gusher. Back in March 2003, President Bush said, and I quote, "We will make sure that Iraqis' natural resources are used for the benefit of their owners, the Iraqi people." So since when did Dallas oil man Ray Hunt get veto power over Iraq's oil minister? You would think it's Iraq's oil minister who decides what's in the best interest of the Iraqi people. By the way, long before 9/11, before he set up shop in the White House, George Bush told a writer friend in Texas that when he got to the White House, he was going to invade Iraq and depose Saddam Hussein. So if you still don't believe the invasion of Iraq was all about oil, talk to Ray Hunt. That Hunt deal is the same kind of crony capitalism that Halliburton got. Halliburton Oil, formerly headed by Bush good buddy Vice President Dick Cheney. Halliburton got a controversial multi-billion no-bid contract to truck oil into Iraq. And its subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, also got named sole source contractor to douse any oil well fires that might break out in Iraq. KBR landed that no-bid plum, even though Bunatim Greenhouse, the Army Corps of Engineers contract chief, found that there were other qualified bidders. Greenhouse refused to put her signature on the deal. And what was her reward for demanding open bidding, for demanding a free enterprise system, an equal chance for every bidder? Her employer, the Army Corps of Engineers, demoted her. Thank you, George Bush, Commander-in-Chief. The Hunt and Halliburton deals offer vivid proof that it's crony capitalism, not the competitive free market brand, that's being practiced when it came to dividing up Iraq's oil resources and the other spoils of war. Look, the wars of America are diverting our attention from the big picture, from global warming, with its increased flooding, tornadoes, droughts, earthquakes. We've even got coming shortages of water and oxygen. Yes, even the very air we breathe. And Carl Savina, president of the Blue Ocean Institute, Cold Spring Harbor, New York, says future historians will look back on our era as dirty, crowded, superstitious, dangerous, and primitive, and that we're running a no-waste recycling economy. And that's got to change, Safina says, because we're running the deficit. We're liquidating our natural capital asset. Something's getting ready to break. Yeah, while Americans comprise just 5% of the world population, we use roughly 30% of the world's non-renewable energy and minerals. Gobble, gobble, gobble. Safina warns forests are shrinking by about an acre per second. During this broadcast, while you've been listening to me, 900 acres of forest have been chopped down. Do we care? Well, you know, I didn't hear any trees fall, did you? Maybe we should think about this parting thought. In this hour of ecological crisis, it is incredible that half of all the tax dollars collected from the American people are used for warfare, rather than to rebuild and rejuvenate the planet we are ravaging. I'm Sherwood Ross. To contact me or contribute to my anti-war news service, email sherwoodross10@gmail.com. That's sherwoodross10@gmail.com. Thanks to Mike Polacek. Thanks to Chuck Gregory. Have a good night.
Thanks to you, Sherwood Ross.
And now for our ninth grade first period civics moment. Please follow along as I read from page one of our textbook, Democracy in America. To change things, because we are a free and open society, unlike so many others, write your congressman, vote, or then write another letter to your congressman. If you don't participate, you have no right to complain. But because you may someday realize these things are useless, you will have to find some extracurricular way to ever actually participate in the running of this country. And let's just say that perhaps by some extraordinary happenstance of money or talent or circumstance, you might actually find you have a voice. That is when your biggest decision will be made. Either shut up and live the good American life or persist in your selfish pursuits. And if you become powerful enough to actually change things and continue to persist in your childish notion of democracy, someone will shoot you between the eyes or in the back of the head. And we will speak no more about you. Now, children, please stand quietly next to your desks for the Pledge of Allegiance. This program is also sponsored by Greatest Generation Beer, brewed from the finest hops and barley something something. Look for the long-haired hippie on the red, white, and blue can, because it's not about killing just because somebody tells you to and not being smart enough to think for yourself. It's all about the courage to fight for what is really right. Greatest Generation Beer. It is actually great. We're also sponsored tonight by the new Court TV talk show, Screaming Show. There is no statute of limitations on slaughter and murder in war criminal court. with Judge Hang'em High Lucy Parsons on the docket for tomorrow's show will be Harry Truman and Enola Gay pilot Paul Tibbetts. And finally, this message from your local hometown friendly bank. We care about you. Come in and have some free coffee and some free cookies on Saturday morning after you go pick up your mulch next to the city shed. And then work as many jobs as you can. Save for a comfortable retirement. Don't worry about the ones who don't have enough food. Go to church. Sit in your lawn chair for the parade. Stand for the military. Go home and die. Member FDIC.
And now we're going to have a discussion with William Bloom. William is an acclaimed author and journalist, U.S. foreign policy expert, author of several books, his latest, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II. He currently sends out a monthly newsletter, The Anti-Empire Report, and resides in the capital of the empire, in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. William, are you there yet?
I'm here.
Well, good. Hello and welcome.
Thank you.
We started our show talking about the farcical announcement purporting to be the death of Osama bin Laden. I'd like to hear your take of this latest bit of propaganda.
Well, I don't think it'll have any practical effect upon U.S. foreign policy. I think it will continue to invade and bomb and overthrow governments and torture and all those nice things. This is not going to change anything at all. So it's purely in the area of image. And I don't have any strong opinion as to whether the story we've been given is factual or not. It may be, but I don't know for sure. But I don't think it matters much.
I think you're probably right there. Why are we in Libya?
Of any significance.
Bill, why is it that we are in Libya at this time?
Why are we in Libya? Oh, because we're an empire, and the empire does not like any countries to stick their nose at us. And Gaddafi is one of the few leaders in the world who has had the guts and the principles to stick his nose at America over the past few decades. And he has to be punished for that. It's not as oil so much as anything as it is that he has to be taught a lesson and painted as a lesson for other leaders. That's the reason that we're against. Listen, in the Middle East and in North Africa in the past few months, there have been much worse leaders. If we were acting on principle, on any kind of moral principle, we would have attacked Egypt or Bahrain. But we chose only Libya and Gaddafi because he is a symbol of standing up to the empire.
By your count, how many nations have we manipulated over the last 40 or 50 years, and how?
You have to define your term.
How many governments have we overthrown? How many leaders have we assassinated?
We've attempted to assassinate more than 50 leaders since the end of the Second World War. We have interfered seriously in elections dozens of times. We have attempted to, intervened militarily dozens of times. I have a long list of this. I can't even think of all of them right now, but those are some of the highlights.
Is there any hope? Is there any way that we may turn this around?
What do you mean by this? U.S. foreign policy?
U.S. foreign policy, the American empire. Are we in decline? Is there any way to turn it around? Can we ever be a free country?
The only people who have the power to do that are the American people, and they are the captive of the media. And the media is a major culprit in this whole scenario. you see all those people at the White House cheering the assassination or the alleged assassination of bin Laden. You know, these people are so hungry to cheer America and scream USA number one, USA. They have to be their education in school and the media which they're surrounded by have to be worked on. It's not too much what people abroad can do to change that situation. It has to be done here in the U.S.
Do the people really have that power anymore? Or for that matter, did they ever?
That's what activists in the U.S. have to be aiming at, raising the consciousness of the masses of people. That's when I write my books and articles, that's what I have in mind. It's education of the mass mind. That's what I'm advocating others to emphasize.
That's certainly what I advocate as well. But sometimes I just get depressed. I feel that no matter how much we, the people, stand up, the few who are on top can just ignore whatever we say, no matter how many of us there are.
But yeah, I know it's a tough job to reach the American mind. One of the main tactics, well, one of the main problems in overcoming that barrier is that the average American is so convinced that no matter what the government does abroad, that its intentions are honorable. They're convinced that our government means well. And as long as they believe that the government means well in its foreign policy, it can be very difficult to change their support of those policies. And that's, in my writing and in my speaking in public, I emphasize this point. I attack the idea that the U.S. government means well in its operations abroad. Because we don't mean well. We have no, there is no honorable motivation in our DNA of our foreign policy. It's, we aim to conquer and to subjugate and to rule the world and exploit it economically. That's what our intentions are. And with the average American who thinks that we actually mean well, those are the ones who are the hardest for people like me to reach.
It's interesting. I find that my own feeling about our intentions abroad is that we're almost exclusively evil, that we have terrible intentions abroad and at home. However, sometimes that can be so overwhelming a concept that I end up just as paralyzed as the people who think that we're doing good.
Well, I can also feel paralyzed, but that's a separate question from the issue of what our intentions are, what the purpose of our foreign policy is. That doesn't mean the fact that I hold these views doesn't mean that I'm happy about it, that I feel carefree about it. I get down also because of what I observe, which makes it very difficult.
Well, I just thought I'd bring that up because I think it's a big problem for those of us who really do care and who see more of what's really going on. It's very easy for us to fall into a trap, and perhaps that's part of the trap that the people in power want us to fall into.
Well, they would like us to feel helpless, of course.
Yeah.
But the media is indispensable in this context. The media have much more effect upon the mass mind than you or I do, much more, of course. So that's the challenge to people like you and I, or any activist.
Well, in the few minutes that we have left to us, I would like you to tell us about your about killinghope.org and your book Killing Hope.
I have four books out, and you can read all about them on my website. The main website I have is killinghope.org, and that will link to the name of one of my books, Killing Hope, and that will link to the other three books that I have out. My second major book is Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. Killing Hope is a collection of narratives of U.S. interventions all over the world. They're told as stories since 1945. And Rogue State is more of an encyclopedia-type book. It's full of lists, including the ones that I mentioned before about all the people we were attempted to assassinate, all the governments we were attempted to overthrow, and all the elections that we have interfered in, and so on. It has all these lists in detail. So if anyone who wants a background to U.S. foreign policy, that's the book to look at.
Well, great. Thank you, Bill, for joining us on the show, and I hope that you'll come back in a month or two and visit with us. And
okay. Maybe, thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The flags are at half staff at the post office and Bueller Chevrolet and the high school and also Taco John's to commemorate and also celebrate the burial at sea of Cruella de Vil, the Wicked Witch of the West, also buried at sea, as well as Captain Hook, buried at sea, and the Big Bad Wolf, buried at sea. No one is thinking yet of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. They are thinking about mulch and mildew. But on the 4th of July, when we will not be able to believe how fast the summer is going, people will begin to remember. And then as they attach their American flags across their windshields with duct tape, they will talk about the legend of Jesus Liberty, the terrorist. It was a big story back in the day, not that long ago, terrible times. And no one knows except maybe old Mr. Lewis, whether the times ever got better, got worse, or whether we just got used to terrible.
Someone was killing the Democrats of Orange County, Nebraska. I wouldn't have cared, but that I was a Democrat. I did not much care to have my throat slit as I pulled into the garage, or have my brakes fail and plow headlong into the concrete culvert out on the bypass around the curb by the new Taco John's, have my head split like a good watermelon, or a 50-pound sack of sugar fall on my neck from the top shelf as I bent down to try to read the label on the All brand with my trifocals. Prime suspect was Jesus Liberty, the terrorist. Jesus lived here in Ace County, somewhere on the back streets or soft dirt roads or in the cornfields. Who knows? Who cares? I might have seen him once, in a blur, in the very early morning out the front window of my auto parts store. But who cares? Maybe the Democrats. Maybe me. You can buy a list of all the registered Democrats from the Secretary of State in Lincoln. I did that once. I used it to get signatures to put on the ballot, to get on the ballot. Suppose you could also use it for selling All brand or for mass murder. To me, I wouldn't go to the trouble. Democrats are dying anyway.
Jesus Liberty got his name when his family was driving up from Oaxaca. His father and mother were illegal. He was illegal too. Illegal people. His mother was pregnant in labor. They needed to find a hospital right away. They passed a woman mowing the front yard of a farm home on a green riding mower, not wearing a top. She had long blonde hair and wore only jean shorts, no shoes, bright red toenail polish. The father got all the detail because they were going 45 on the highway, not wanting to have anything to do with the county deputies. The woman went over some bumps in the lawn, held on, looked right at the father and smiled and waved. He recalled that at that particular moment, her hair rose from her shoulders, suspended in midair with waves like on the American commercials they had seen from home. Perhaps just what he had dreamed of when he thought of America, perhaps miraculous, though he kept that suspicion to himself. When the father saw the blonde woman, he proclaimed, Dios mio, liberty. And when Jesus was born in the county hospital 20 minutes later, the father wanted to memorialize the vision he had been given. The mother argued they could not name the son my God. So the father agreed on Jesus and tacked on liberty as a middle name because that was truly how it had occurred. And they wanted it to sound as if the young boy was from around here. The father and mother and the nurses had bickered about the comma. Mr. and Mrs. having spent many weeks studying English and having the fervor of the nouveau literate, and for 2 days the name of the young boy was Jesus, Liberty Hernandez. On the third day, the comma was dropped.
The mother and father opened a restaurant, worked all day every day, and bought a home on the west side. Jesus grew strong and happy and played shortstop and quarterback. He was famous, known around town as Jesus Liberty. Just as the Omaha World Herald headline on the Sunday sports page after Jesus was named the High School Athlete of the Year in only his junior year. He planned to attend the University of Nebraska and study architecture, build tall buildings in Grand Island and San Francisco and Mexico City, and be the first Hispanic quarterback ever, the first Hispanic Nebraskan elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. His room was packed with the biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, another great American designer, Thomas U. Walter in the U.S. Capitol building, James Hoban's White House, Henry Bacon in the Lincoln Memorial, Robert Mills in the Washington Memorial, Russell Pope's Jefferson Memorial. In the family's photo album, he saw pictures of the modest hovels of Oaxaca and compared them to the homes he saw in America. His father and mother were able to move the family to a house on Madison Street. Jesus spent hours sitting out on the front porch, watching people go past, waving and smiling. They often did not respond positively when he did that. What he really wanted to do was make houses like those in America for his relatives in Mexico, or bring those relatives up here to live in nice places, or maybe play shortstop for the New York Yankees. Each day, his dreams and plans were different, bigger, larger, more grand, and beautiful. The high school did not offer architecture classes, but Mr. Myers, the shop teacher, gave Jesus books on construction, bricklaying, carpentry, steel beam structure, the building of the Hoover Dam and the World Trade Center, and Yankee Stadium, the St. Louis Arch.
Jesus Liberty stopped going to classes after the first week of his senior year. Mrs. Langford, the history teacher, pulled a television into the room on September 11th, 2001, so her classes could watch the continuing coverage. Jesus sat in the front desk of the second row from the door and watched CNN all morning. He watched through his class and skipped biology and geometry, too, to watch more. He got up when Mrs. Langford locked her room for lunch. Jesus Liberty dropped his books in his locker, walked through the cafeteria without talking to anyone, went out the front door with the rest of the privileged open campus seniors and never came back. He sent a letter to the editor of the paper from somewhere, and the editor wouldn't print it, is what I heard. Said it didn't have a local address.
Jesus Liberty had left that classroom on 9/11 and walked across the front yard and parking lot to the baseball field to sit in the visitor's dugout. That's what I learned later. I heard that's when he wrote that letter to the editor that the old editor refused to print. He left his books in the dugout and he walked across town. He walked into the friendly cafe and sat at one of the tables like a regular customer. His mother came out to ask why he wasn't at school. He nodded at the TV high in the corner behind the front counter at the images replayed of the towers coming down. "Controlled demolition," he said dejectedly. His mother brought him a chicken enchilada and rice with a cherry Coke in his special glass. Maria sat with her son and silently watched him eat and look up at the television. They stared deep into each other's eyes, knowing their world had changed forever. The mother knew, because she'd never seen her son quite like this before. Jesus Liberty knew, because he had never understood before. He talked with his parents late at night, around the tables, after the customers had gone home. Colorful blankets covering the front window, which the town cop could not see through unless he were to park his car and get out, which he wouldn't do in a million years. The parents tried to get Jesus to go back to school to finish his education, but Jesus knew he had already learned too much. He'd already taken all his architecture textbooks and biographies and set them by the front door of the restaurant for Mr. Myers to find when he came for lunch on a Wednesday.
Jesus thought of people in town he could talk to. He watched the TV and listened to the news reporters prepare the people for war. He saw the yellow ribbons and stickers on the vehicles around town. The family did not answer the phone calls from the school. They hid Jesus like a dissident when the principal, Mrs. Sample, came to the restaurant to ask about him. Jesus spent his days thinking and watching CNN and eating too many ho-hos. His father would hide him in the back seat of the car and take Jesus and his dog, Gypsy, out to the county park in the country so that Jesus could get out of the house and walk and be away from the TV. One day, Jesus came downstairs for breakfast and said he was going to hold a sign downtown. "I'm going to do it," he said, "for God, for country, for honor, just like on TV. I'm going to fight for my country, die if I must, like a dirty dog in the street with my tongue and guts hanging out." "No, mijo," his mother shrieked and put both her hands to her mouth. His father smirked and then became serious. "You cannot stop what is happening, what is going to happen," said the father. Jesus gritted his teeth and became angry in an instant. His father put up a hand. Jesus sat down. "Go away," said the father, trying not to cry. "You must go away." He put up his hand again to stop the mother's protests. "Go to Mexico City, Oaxaca, Chiapas. See your people. See where you came from. That is where you were conceived, mijo. This is not your country. We were wrong to bring you here. We thought it would be better." He put his chin to his chest and sobbed. Jesus sat in silence as his parents prepared for bed. He sat out on the porch thinking, ready to leap the railing if a police car came down Madison Street. The next morning when his parents came out for coffee, Jesus had a Yankees gym bag by the door. His parents helped him with a list of relatives and a map, then hid him in the back seat for the drive to the bus depot in Mount Carl. They had coffee and split a sweet roll in a booth at Casey's before he left, never to return. And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the weekend summer help crime scene photographers are about average.
And now our profiles and heart to those who have given or are still giving their heart and soul, helping us all have a better world. Our thanks for caring. And remember, Mr. Byron does not teach American history in room 203 at 10 a.m. in Sheboygan. He didn't yesterday. He won't tomorrow or never. Mr. Byron doesn't know anything about American history. He does not want to. And that's why he's been there for 33 years. If any of these names are not familiar, give him a Google search. It's worth it. And again, our thanks.
Lori Berenson.
Mitch Snyder.
Coleman McCarthy.
Jimmy Breslin.
Mike Royko.
Paul Wellstone.
Charles Bukowski.
Ernie Chambers.
Dorothy Kilgallen.
Molly Rush.
And Mae Brussel.
And now, as we close our show, I want to make sure that you know to stay tuned right here for Black Op Radio. Coming up next, our sponsor, Rock Creek Free Press, we thank them very much. We also thank World News Trust at worldnewstrust.com for sponsoring our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. I'd like you to know we also have another website, www.newamericandream.net, and we have a website for pretty much every book that Mike's ever written, and there are a lot of them. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I run CWGServices.com, where I build some websites, and I build all of these. And I'd be glad to consider working for any of you if you're interested. Join us again next week, same time, same place. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Carl Rove. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
I see. It's sad sometimes. You ever realize that we live in a world where good men are murdered and mediocre hacks thrive? You ever notice that? John Kennedy murdered. Gandhi. murdered. Martin Luther King, murdered. Jesus, murdered. Reagan, wounded. Cancer 8 times. Now that fucker still walks. That guy is Jason, man. You can take off that hockey mask just once. You're going to find, well, I'm back. People love him. Love him. Every fact points that he's a liar, corporate puppet, devil, cock-sucking fascist. Every fact points to that. Not one fact to the opposite. But what happened? We love you, Ronnie.
4 more years. 4 more years.
Let's put him on Mount Rushmore. Let's put him under Mount Rushmore. They love him. How far up your ass does this guy's dick have to be before you realize he's fucking you, man? People are just, I like him. I don't know what it is. He looks good on TV. He brought back patriotism. God damn it, he's a good American. Hold it, something's slapping my ass. Oh my God, he's fucking us! Well, Nancy and I feel that. Man, you might know, as John Wayne once told me, that. Man, you might remember if Jimmy Stewart... Well, shut the fuck up. You answer a question like a man, you fucking lying, be actor, dickweed, Mr. President, sir. With all due respect...